The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested indirectly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Securities offered through Cambridge Investment Research Incorporated, a broker-dealer member FINRA SIPC. Advisory services offered through Cambridge Investment Research Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Saulnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor. Jim Saulnier & Associates, LLC, and Cambridge are not affiliated.
This is the Retirement and IRA Show coming to you from beautiful Northern Colorado. Join us as certified financial planner Jim Saulnier, as well as Colorado State University finance instructor and certified financial planner Chris Stein, teach you about IRAs, 401ks, annuities, Social Security, pension plans, and estate planning in a fun and enjoyable show. Whether you are listening live in Colorado or streaming from their website or iTunes podcast, Jim and Chris want you to know that they're available to help you plan for your retirement. Just visit their website at jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. And click the Meet the Team button on the homepage. Now, here's Jim and Chris with today's show.
Well, welcome to the Retirement and IRA Show Q&A edition, where we're going to do our best, not your best. We're going to do our best at answering your questions today. Before we get into that, I do want to apologize to those who listen live. Last couple of weeks, today included, we've been so busy with things in the office that we haven't gone live as we normally do, a little bit later, about a couple hours late today. So, those of you who are used to listening live, we apologize. You can still pick us up as normal in the recorded podcast area. But that also leads me to mention that if you are looking, if you're a financial planner, financial advisor, preferably a certified financial planner with a few years of experience, and you're interested in maybe coming on board with us to give us a hand, one of the reasons why we're behind getting the podcast out there today is that we were just working on tons of business that we were dealing with. So we are looking to hire another planner. So I know there's a number of planners out there who listen to our show. And if you're embracing our approach, that's going to be a must. We do things kind of our way. Those of you who have listened for a while know that what we do is a bit unique. We talk about things a little bit differently and approach things a little bit differently. And so clearly the ideal candidate to work with us would be somebody who embraces our approach. So just shoot us an email if you're interested. Probably just shoot one to Jim directly, jim@jimhelps.com. Probably the best way to get your foot in the door. We can take a look and chat with you a little bit about it. But beyond that, we've got a series of questions that Jim is rifling through right now to decide what we're going to answer today. I know we've got a nice pile.
We do. We have updates on Secure Act and Social Security questions, tons of IRA questions, just a lot of questions in general. I do want to give a few updates on the Secure Act because we were chatting. Remember we answered a question recently on the Secure Act? I think we answered a few questions on the Secure Act. But anyways, it was someone with an annuity, remember?
Oh, and they're asking if that existing annuity was going to be impacted by changes in the Secure Act.
Right, and then you and I started coming up with all these what if, ands, and buts.
True, yeah, I do remember that.
Okay, yeah. Well, I get some answers to some of the what if, ands, and buts.
Oh, very nice. So this is kind of a follow-up to a previous question.
Follow-up to a previous question. And one thing I did want to point out, and I didn't go back and listen, but I think you might have made a mistake in one of the things you said, or you might have nailed it, and I remember wrong. But we were talking at one phase with how If a minor inherits, a minor child inherits an IRA from a parent, that child doesn't get subject, if you will, to the new rules under the Secure Act until they reach the age of majority. And that part is true. But I thought you might have said, Chris, that they don't have to take anything out until they reach the age of majority, and then they can wait 10 years. Well, actually, it doesn't work that way.
Right, and if I said that, I misspoke.
I don't remember.
Because I remember talking about that, about them receiving it. And yes, I admit it's possible I said that. That would be wrong. The regular RMDs from the old way work, correct?
And he is right. And I went to another presentation recently, and as we started diving into this, well, I'll share with the listeners in a second. So the way the rule works now, if you leave your IRA to your children and they are a minor, they will be subject to the old rules, which means they have to start required minimum distribution. Even as a minor child, the money would go into a custodial account, but they have to begin the required minimum distributions by December 31st of the year following the year they inherit the IRA. So if you passed away in 2020, they would have to start RMDs by December 31st of 2021.
And if they don't do that, then they're going to be defaulted into the five-year rule, correct?
Depending on the age of the parent when they died. I don't want to get too far into that weed.
But could be subject to the five-year rule.
Could be subject to the five-year rule.
So that would completely blow up. If you were trying to minimize the amount that they're forced to take out, that would implode if you if they missed that date and were they became subject to the five-year rule.
Unless you died after age 70 and a half.
Yeah, right.
Which gets really confusing. Yeah. Okay, so what happens, though, is when your child reaches the age of majority. So initially, let's just say the child was five, and I'll make that up. It was five, and a five-year-old would actually use the single life table for the following year, not the age they are in the year they inherit it, but the age they are the following year. That would be 76.7. So in other words, the government is saying that a five-year-old will most likely live 76.7 more years.
Right. And the RMD on $1 million would be about $13,000.
Not much at all.
And but that's, so if I did say they don't have to take anything out, in the grand scheme of things, it's quite a small amount. Right. It's divided by 76.
I just wanted to make sure you all realized. Now, when the child reaches the age of majority, which in the state of Colorado, I was at a meeting today, a lunch meeting, and it was all estate planning attorneys, CPAs, and financial planners. Mm-hmm. No one agreed on when the hell it was.
In Colorado, yeah.
Half said 18, the other half said 21.
Mm-hmm.
I said, I don't know.
Well, and it's actually, there's three phases, and I don't know what the official one is. There's different things that trigger at 18, 19, and 21.
Well, not only that, one of the presenters pointed out to us exactly that, that there are some states whose age of majority depends if the child's in school or not. And he didn't tell us which states, but he claimed some of the states, or some states, it is when the child is finished even an advanced degree, which could take them well into their late 20s. So his point was this, when it comes to the Secure Act, and he shared with us that his wife was an estate planning attorney for Nationwide, the insurance company, and that Nationwide has decided to not honor the Secure Act. In other words, they're not going to deal with the BS, they said, and they're going to force you to move your money. They don't want to deal with inherited IRAs. Now, that is from him. I have no proof on that, but I figured I would share that today because his point was, every state, there's 50 states that have all these different age of majority rules. The law is a federal law based on the states. How confusing is that for the companies? Depends what state the kid's in. And what if the kid moves to another state? We didn't have clarity on that.
Right.
What if he inherits it from one state but moves to another state?
Yeah.
What if the kid drops out of school? Goes back to school.
Yeah. This is a big.
This is a
this
mess.
Is a big bag of worms here.
A big, yeah. A big mess. So he claimed today that Nationwide has decided to not honor beneficiary IRAs, just not allow them, and say, no, move your money to a custodian who wants to deal with this. We don't want them. Now, if that is true, and I don't know why he would tell us it was true if it wasn't. He said his wife is estate planning attorney for the Nationwide company. I think Nationwide might be overreacting a little, but I sympathize that it is incredibly difficult. So anyways, back to what I wanted to clarify on. If your minor child inherits your IRA, and again, there's ambiguity in a room full of estate planning attorneys, CPAs, and financial planners. There was half the group. It was kind of like that Miller Lite commercial. Taste great, less filling. Taste great, less filling. Instead, it was 18, 21, 18, 20, and no one agreed. The 18 people thought it was 18, and the 21 people thought it was 21. And here is a room full of professionals that you think would know the state they live in, age of majority. I think it's 18. I didn't vote.
For
I
Colorado.
Sat there quiet. Yeah,
I think it's 18.
I was
well.
Eating my salmon salad and didn't want to get involved in all that. But nonetheless, people didn't agree. And that's when the moderator butted in and said, now you know, and he shared with us the Nationwide why they don't want to get involved with it, because no one knows this. You have a federal law based on 50 individual states' age of majority. So what happens when the child does reach the age of majority, though, assuming you can even figure out
whatever age that
what
is.
The age of majority is? They have to begin with the 10-year rule, which means their RMDs stop and nothing has to come out, but the entire account has to be emptied within 10 years of reaching the age of majority.
Right.
So anyways, I wanted to clarify that. And then I wanted to clarify some of the rabbit hole that Chris and I started going down, because we were saying, what happens at the death of what happens at the death of your child? I mean, God, I don't want you to, as a parent, to ever think of that. But let's just say a 5-year-old child inherited the IRA under the old rules. They could keep it open for 76.7 years. How did I come up with that? For those who are checking at home, you do not use the single life table on the at the age the child inherited it. It's the age the following year. So the following year, the kid would have been 6, and the single life table at 76.7. So Chris and I started going down this rabbit hole saying, what happens if that child dies? And there we were a little unsure, and we started saying, well, what if an eligible designated beneficiary inherits it? The new eligible designated beneficiary are the people who are eligible for a stretch IRA. And that would be a spouse. It would be someone not more than 10 years younger, not more than 10 years younger than you.
Right.
It would be a disabled person. It would be someone with a chronic illness and qualifies for long-term care coverage by not being able to do 2 of 6 activities of daily living. That's a screwed up rule right there in and of itself. And it's your child, not your grandchild, but your child, as long as they're under the age of majority. Can you see how messy this is getting?
Yeah.
And then you and I were wondering, well, if they inherit it, can they step in and start stretching? And I found out from the Ed Slott group the answer to these questions. No. Any person who inherits an IRA that had already been inherited, who is going to step in with what the industry calls the successor beneficiary, and under the old rules, if your 5-year-old inherited your IRA, they could keep it open 76.7 years. Mm-hmm. And what if they passed away 36 years later?
Mm-hmm.
So now you would have 40 years remaining, 40.7.
Right. Yep.
40 years remaining, so that person's spouse, that person's child, that person's friend, relative, whatever, could have stepped in and kept that IRA open for another 40 right. years.
Essentially stepping in and resuming or continuing on with the RMD schedule that was set about from the original inheritor of the IRA.
So Chris and I were wondering, though, well, what if the person who steps in is an eligible designated beneficiary under the new rules? Could they stretch it out? The answer is anyone who inherits an inherited IRA, anyone who steps in as what the industry calls successor beneficiary under the Secure Act is subject to the 10-year payout. Doesn't matter who it is. Doesn't
at least
matter
that's a nice clean rule.
Who it is. It simplifies it because
yeah.
it would get...
Yeah.
You think it's complicated now?
Yeah.
I mean, the amazing thing is so many people just hear the what I call the headline rule.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, 10 years.
Yep.
And no one really digs into the what ifs. I'm amazed. I love the what ifs. I love peeling that onion skin back. But they really simplified it. If a successor beneficiary steps in, 10-year rule applies. So let's go back to this scenario. What if someone inherited under a single life table but was a lot older than 5? They were 65 when they inherited it. So we go to the single life table under the old rules for a 66-year-old, 20 years. And under the old rules, if that person passed away 19 years later, someone could step into their shoes and keep it open for just one more year.
Mm-hmm.
But under the new rules, if that were to happen and someone passed away with 1 year left, the 10-year rule automatically applies.
Now, there wouldn't be a lot in there.
No, wouldn't.
With only 1 year left.
True. But that's how it works. So I wanted to clarify, what happens if an eligible designated beneficiary steps in as the successor beneficiary? 10-year rule. If you are a successor beneficiary, in other words, you're inheriting an IRA that's already been inherited, 10-year rule applies, case closed, no ifs, ands, and buts about it, no matter who you are. You could be that person's spouse, and it doesn't matter. 10-year rule applies. And when a minor child inherits it, they don't get to sit on it and do nothing until reaching the age of majority. They actually have to begin RMDs under the old rules, which were the stretch IRA rules. And then when they reach the age of majority, the new rules take over. But again, the person today who presented at lunch today, Chris, he felt strongly that a lot of custodians, especially, and he worked for an insurance company, I won't say which one, and his wife was an estate planning attorney for Nationwide. And I might as well say the company he worked for, Liberty Bankers or something like that. I never heard of him, but Liberty Bankers Life or something. But he was a very knowledgeable man. He was a very pleasurable man. But he shared with us something that you and I knew. Most insurance companies have software that's a decade or two old. And he named one major insurance company that I will keep quiet because I think they finally improved. But they were still using DOS as of a few years ago. Mm. Few years ago.
Right.
And this is if I told you this company,
yeah, you'd know.
You'd know it.
Yeah.
And his point is a lot of insurance companies are not going to have the software to track all 50 states, all of these ifs, ands, and buts, mm-hmm. track when the kid is reaching the age of majority, track if they move to another state, track all mm-hmm. this other stuff.
Right, and they're worried about doing something wrong, and then the client sues them for doing a transaction or not giving them the right advice or something
and
like that. So they're just going to wash their hands of it. I can see it. We obviously can't trust a rumor here. There's been no official announcement that I know of from Nationwide, but would not shock me if we start to see companies take this stance, maybe eventually putting pressure, maybe the insurance industry, which has very, very solid lobbying groups, might be able to get something put through that cleans this up a little bit. As they maybe point out to Congress and the IRS what a mess this could potentially be. So
Exactly. Nice. Okay, got a couple of Social Security questions here for you. Okay. This one is fairly straightforward. I think we answered it 14 times already, but I don't think another time would hurt at all.
No.
Okay. This is from a Mississippian, and it's a female, but we are going to call her Georgette, even though she gave us her real name. We're going to protect her anonymity. And she says, my question, can I receive a divorced spouse benefit when my ex turns 62? He's not yet retired, and he tells everyone he just wants to keep working and working. We were married 18 years. I've been divorced from him since 2000. I've never remarried, and I am 10 years older than him already. I'm 72. When he turns 62 later this year, can I file? If not, how will I ever know when he does finally decide to retire?
This is a good news answer. Yes, you can absolutely file under a divorced spouse benefit. If your ex-spouse becomes eligible to claim, which is at 62, you do not have to wait for them to have claimed as long as the divorce was at least 2 years ago. They have that little loophole killer so that people don't get divorced simply to take advantage of this rule. You'd have to be divorced for 2 full years before the requirement that the ex-spouse claim to unlock the spousal benefit. In this case, they've been divorced for quite some time. So all that she's been waiting for in this case is for him to turn 62, and she clearly knows his birthday, doesn't have to communicate with him, doesn't have to get his permission. She just goes to the Social Security Administration, claims the divorce spouse benefit, has to provide proof that they were in fact married and then divorced. Having the ex's Social Security number is highly recommended, so don't throw away all the paperwork after you get divorced. Because you might run into a situation like this. And this rule, or of forgiving the requirement that the spouse claim, which is what would have to, that would be the rule if they were still married. This is one case where being divorced actually relaxes the rule. And it's for reasons like she mentioned, how would I know when he retires and claims? Maybe we don't talk to each other, or maybe they do talk. Not friendly, but he decides he's just going to work till he passes away and never file for Social Security. If there was still this rule where he would have to file to unlock the door to her, he could essentially hold her spousal benefit hostage. So they remove all of that by giving you this free pass once you've been divorced for 2 years. And so as long as your ex has turned 62, you've been married at least 10 years. They measure the 10 years on the actual anniversary. So you've got to make it to that anniversary date. Don't get divorced a few days too early. Then you forego this opportunity. But as long as you've been married for 10 years and divorced for at least two, you are allowed to claim as soon as your ex is 62. Now, in this case, the fact that he's 62 does not reduce her spousal benefit. This is another piece I'm kind of expanding on this answer, because a lot of people know when you file early, which 62 would be early, his benefit, if he were to file, would be reduced. But because she's older at or beyond her own full retirement age, she is eligible for a full spousal benefit, which is one half of his full retirement age benefit called his PIA. So she can file as soon as he turns 62. The fact that she's 72 means there'll be absolutely no penalty or reduction for early filing, because she's not filing early. And so I guess my answer is just full of good news.
Excellent. I knew you'd be able to answer that one. Okay, this one we've answered before in on the podcast, but such a long time ago, and it gets a little bit complicated, so I wanted to highlight it again. And of course, it's not here in front of me. Where the heck did it go? Oh, well, this stinks. Now you can tell we do this live. Ah, I got it. Don't have to start doing that. I got it. If people saw the mess in front of me, they'd understand why this is going
on. Well, in your free time, if you'd straighten it up, this would go a lot more.
Oh, yeah, I got tons of free time.
Yeah, no problem.
Okay, so this one, I don't know who or where they're from. They don't list that, but they do begin. Hi, Jim and Chris.
That's us.
That is us. I just realized I contributed to my Roth IRA in 2017 when I wasn't eligible to do so.
Oopsie daisies.
I should have put the money in a non-deductible IRA. Can I just call Vanguard, another Vanguardian, can I just call Vanguard and tell them to recharacterize the 2017 contribution to a non-deductible IRA, then file Form 5329 for 2017, 2018, and 2019 while paying the 6% penalty for each year? If we had the soundbite from Get Smart that we sometimes played in the past, missed it by that much. Mm-hmm. You're close, but you're not quite close. So let me explain what happens. So I didn't get a hold of this gentleman or gentlewoman. Don't know if it's a man or a woman. I just assumed they were over the age of 50, and I'm going to use those contribution amounts just because that's what I choose to do. So in 2017, if you were over the age of 50 and eligible to contribute to a Roth IRA, you could have put $6,500 into a Roth IRA. Let's just assume that's what you did, listener. You put $6,500 in. Now, fast forward to 2020. You sent this email about a month ago. So you discovered a month ago that money you put in 3 years, I'm guessing he was doing his taxes, he or she was doing his taxes, and for some reason realized, holy moly.
Dawned on him that he had exceeded the earnings limit.
I wasn't allowed to do this. Yeah. So you put excess money in 2017. I'm also going to assume you weren't allowed to put any money in 2017.
Right.
It is quite possible, though, listener, you might have been able to put some money in.
Right.
So maybe not all $6,500 is an excess contribution.
Right. So you might, maybe you're in the middle of the phase out is what Jim is referring to.
But I'm keeping it simple here.
Right. He's
but
blown
do
past.
Do mm-hmm. check, listener, if you were allowed to contribute anything in 2017. Mm-hmm. And you've got to go use 2017 numbers and rules. So don't look at the phase out limits of 2020. You've got to use the phase out limits of 2017. Mm-hmm. But for my answer, let's assume all $6,500 was an excess contribution.
Mm-hmm.
You had until October 15th of 2018 to remove the excess contribution and any associated earnings with that excess contribution. You could have recharacterized it like you asked. Recharacterizations are not allowed for conversions, folks, but they're still allowed for everything else.
Right.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
So don't think, oh, knee-jerk reaction, recharacterizations aren't allowed anymore. Oh, yes, they are. They're just not allowed if you do conversions. So you could have, listener, recharacterized the $6,500 plus any earnings minus any losses. There's a whole calculation you have to do. We won't bore you with it. Google it. You can find how to do it. And put that money into a non-deductible IRA, no harm, no foul,
right.
Except the earnings would have been subject to taxes.
Right.
Okay, that's it. Excuse me, if you recharacterized it, the earnings wouldn't have been subject to taxes because they would have been considered done from day one.
Correct.
So I stand corrected there. I misspoke. Yeah. Okay, but it's 2020. So what happens is after October 15th of the year following the year you made the excess contribution, I've got good news and I've got bad news. The good news is any earnings on that money that's been sitting there since 2017 and barring the coronavirus contagion that seemed to take over the market this week, pretty much anything you bought in 2017 is worth more in 2020. The good news is what, Chris?
Those earnings get to stay in there and be in the Roth tax-free eventually if you make a qualified withdrawal and don't have to be removed.
Forever they can stay
forever
in
and ever. So it's a, I don't know if you'd call it a loophole. It's just how the rules are written. Not a lot of people understand that intricacy to the rules. So it is before October 15th that everything has to come out in order to call no harm, no foul. But in this particular case, you're beyond that cutoff of October 15th of the year following the excess contribution. And the earnings now are treated very differently than the contribution itself. It's the contribution that's the offender now moving forward. And it's on that contribution that you have to deal with the issue and the penalties.
Right. Now, if you, again, try to fix this within the time period of being exempt from the 6% penalty, which is October 15th of the year following the year the excess contribution was made, the earnings would have to have been removed. But if you go to fix it after October 15th of the year after the year you make the excess contribution, earnings don't have to be removed. It's one of those bizarre rules, but that's a rule. Mm-hmm. However, you are now subject to the 6% penalty. So Right. There's the trade-off.
Yearly.
And for you, it's 3 years worth. 2017, 18, and 19. You're not going to be subject to 2020s because you can fix it this year. But you will have 3 years of penalty owed on the excess contribution. That's 6% a year on the $6,500. However, I have potential good news for you. You will owe the 6% penalty on 2017. Why is that? You already told us you weren't eligible to make the contribution. And remember, in my answer, I'm assuming you weren't eligible to make any contribution. So you will owe 6% on $6,500, Chris, which is what?
$390.
So you owe a penalty of $390.
For the 2017, for sure.
Correct. Mm-hmm. And you are also correct, listener. You will file the 2017 version, I wanted to make that clear, of Form 5329. You're going to fill in page 2, bottom section. I'm pretty sure it's page 2 on the bottom section. Yeah, I'm 99%
sure it's
page 2. Used to
be. They changed the
form. Did they change it? Okay. There's a bunch of sections on there. You're going to fill in the section that's appropriate. It used to be page 3, last section. But irrespective, you will find the correct section on the 2017 5329. So make sure you Google 2017 Form 5329. It will pop up. And it is the only tax form that requires its own signature, so it need not be attached to your 1040. You are going to sign this penalty form, attach your penalty, and send it in. So that's 2017. What about 18 and what about 19? Here's where the news gets potentially good. If your ability to contribute to a Roth IRA came back in 2018, mm-hmm. 2018, the limit was also $6,500. Let's say your earnings were a little bit low and you were allowed to contribute $3,000. Well, that $3,000 contribution wipes out $3,000 of the $6,500 excess contribution still sitting in your Roth. Mm-hmm. So when you do the 2018 Form 5329, you got to Google 2018 Form 5329 and use that form. Your excess contribution for that year, in my example, is now $3,500 because I said, let's pretend you were eligible to contribute three. So in other words, listener, you have to determine every year if you were eligible to make a Roth contribution. In a perfect world, you might have been fully eligible in 2018 to contribute $6,500. And then you owe no penalty for 2018 or 19. But if you weren't allowed to contribute anything, you will owe another 6% on the $6,500. And I misspoke. You actually don't attach the check to the 5329. You file the 5329 admitting you made the mistake. They will send you a bill for the mistake plus the late payment penalty. They'll add all that on for you. They're very nice. So then you're going to do that for 2018 and 2019. So my hope for you, listener, is that maybe you weren't allowed to contribute to a Roth in 2017, but you were allowed to make some or all of the contribution in 2018 and 2019, thereby reducing the penalty that you will owe. But I would file all three forms, 2017, 18, and 19's, 5329, or if the amount you could contribute wiped out one of those years, then you're all set, but file for the years that the penalty does apply. And if you still haven't removed the money and you don't have any offset, in other words, you weren't allowed to contribute in 2017, 18, or 19.
Or 20.
Then now in 2020, get the money out because you're going to keep paying a 6% penalty as long as that money stays in.
Right.
So then you would have to contact Vanguard, your Roth custodian, and request a removal of excess contribution.
Make sure they code it as
right.
such. Yeah.
Don't just take out $6,500. That's a withdrawal.
Right.
You need to remove an excess contribution made in 2017. So it will be coded as a removal of excess contribution. So make sure you word that to him. But the hope is he can reduce some of his penalties by reducing the amount of the excess contribution by using his allowable 2018 and 19 contributions if he was eligible.
Right. And just for clarity, I pulled up the 2017 5329, and the 6% tax on additional on excess contributions to a Roth is the very bottom section of the first page.
First
now.
Page, not second.
It's part four. Part three is excess contributions to a traditional, which is right above that, of course. And then on the back end, you end up with additional contributions or excess contributions to Coverdell's, Archer MSAs, health savings accounts and ABLE accounts are on the back. So you're looking at the bottom of page one for the juicy stuff in this particular case for
Excellent.
2017.
Okay. We're on a roll. Let's keep going because I know we got to wrap up real soon. We started late and it's getting late. Okay. So this one is more of a, where the hell is it? Oh, where the heck is it? I'm supposed to say heck more. Here it is. Here is someone who's trying to throw yours truly under the bus. He did it again. He spelled Chris, J-I-M. Clearly.
Well, I see.
He
People just consistently
they
make
consistently
that
do
I think
that.
He might have caught me on one, though. I think I might have said what you accused me of before about none.
Yeah.
And it was, my mind was thinking, oh, it's so minuscule because they're going to be a minor five or whatever. I don't want to go back there again, but you might have caught me on that one.
When I read that, I was like, oh, wait, I think Chris said that.
So.
Okay. But anyways, so here is someone.
So you should take full responsibility of this one.
Well, again, if this guy knew how to spell Chris, but anyways, he writes, hello, financial planning gurus. I enjoy your show more than cake, and I love cake.
Wow.
I like cake, too.
Me, too.
It's
almost my birthday, too.
Cake is good. Is it almost your birthday?
Well, a month.
Okay. Because Shauna's one of the new things Shauna has to do in the office is keep track of people's birthdays and
ask them what they want. She asked me what I wanted.
A gift? I didn't tell her we're giving gifts.
No, the type of cake.
Okay. Hopefully you said chocolate cake with white frosting.
No, that's yours. Huh. I don't like that one.
Damn it. I don't like any other cake but chocolate.
I'm a yellow cake with chocolate frosting.
Oh, yellow cakes are disgusting.
It's just yellow.
It's disgusting. It should be chocolate. Chocolate cake, white frosting. Anyways.
Moving on.
I enjoy the show more than I like cake, and I love cake. But I'm looking for clarification, Jim. And then he put in parentheses, yes, you, Jim, not Chris. Apparently he's a longtime listener. But I still think he meant Chris.
I think he's pretty clear.
Jim, you often describe health savings accounts as having four tax benefits, better than the trifecta, with the fourth benefit being contributions if made by an employer are exempt from Social Security taxes. Do you want to walk through the trifecta? Do you know what I'm getting at? Contributions to an HSA
are tax deductible
up front,
yep.
Grow tax free and are removed.
Grow
tax
technically
free.
Technically tax deferred. You just have to
grow
make
tax
it,
deferred.
Then, but if you take
and then
them
withdrawn
out,
tax free if used for
medical expenses, it's tax free. So
that's
tax
the
free, tax free, tax free.
That's the trifecta. But there is a quadfecta that we have talked about. Mm-hmm. If an employer makes the contributions for you, which some do. The money that they put into the HSA is exempt from Social Security and Medicare taxes. So it reduces your income, and it will not be, just like the money you put into your 401k is mm-hmm. subject to Medicare and Social Security taxes.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
But money you put into an HSA is not. So we have used that as a quad factor if made by the employer or coming through payroll deduction, if you will. We would put that as a quad factor. However, he accuses me of something that I always thought we hedged, and that was you would be paying a little bit less into Social Security. And if your aim is to grow your Social Security benefit, this may not be something good. So he points that out. I could have sworn, maybe not on every show that we talk about.
No, I'm sure we don't mention
factor,
it every single time.
But I know there were times that I have, because I knew this. But anyways, he continues throwing you under the bus.
But it's small.
He says, however, I feel that is misleading. For people who work corporate jobs and earn under the Social Security's earnings limit.
Yeah.
Because that means the amount you contribute to an HSA from your employer is not going to be included in your earnings history and will lower your Social Security. I'm only 26 years old and I listen to your show regularly, and apparently he loves cake. And I want to compare my Social Security's earnings history to my paycheck and ensure they match, so I check every year. So in other words, he's checking on this. And since I don't earn more than the earnings limit, your benefit, and he put that in quotation marks, as you describe it, is not as adventurous a benefit to me in the fact my Social Security will now be lower. If I was earning more than the earnings limit, perhaps this wouldn't be such an issue. Keep up the great show, and I am such a dork that the two weekly episodes you do per week is my version of watching Netflix. Wow, cool.
Wow. Well, I will say, if you're making over about, in 2020, about $70,000 a year, that's approximate, because that puts you in after the second bend point in the AMI. Not to get too technical, but this person obviously pays a lot of attention, so he'll likely know what I'm talking about. The replacement rate is only 10% at that level. So the bang for your buck, if you will, the additional withholding that you have on earnings above that amount, you were talking about the limit, which is, what, $138,000 roughly? It's $137,700 in 2020. There's quite a lot of earnings there that you're going to be paying Social Security taxes on and only be getting a dime on a dollar
replaced what Chris is saying
in your AMI.
And I follow exactly what you're saying. But the first dollars you put into Social Security increase your Social Security benefit far more than latter dollars.
Right.
And what Chris is saying is if you earned more than 70-something thousand.
In 2020, it's $5,785 a month. So I just rounded it up. It's you know, $5,785 times 12 is $69,420. So I was off $580.
So if you're earning more than 70 grand already of earnings and you're going to put money in through your employer, even though that $6,500 isn't going towards Social Security, it's adding so little to your benefit.
Correct.
The first 70 added the majority of the benefit.
Right.
But he goes on, and I didn't read his last paragraph, but this ties into what you're saying, and I think, listener, you might be wrong here. You're eating a little too much cake. He goes on to say, it's my understanding that I could do a workaround. I can set up my own HSA and not contribute through my employer, claim a deduction while getting it reported on my earnings. All's what I will be giving up is my $500 employer match. I think
you're shooting
that,
yourself in your
yeah,
foot.
Yeah, I think that $500 is worth more than what that additional
I'd have to
Social
do some
Security.
Calculations, but my gut is telling me the $500 is better.
Especially you're 26, dude. You're hopefully not consuming health care. That money could probably grow 30, 40 years. Think of the compounding. And because, now again, if you are earning less than $70,000, if you're only earning $20,000, $25,000, $30,000, maybe your math makes sense. I don't know. We have software that could figure it out, but obviously we can't do it. We're not being paid, and you ain't going to want to pay us to figure this out. Trust me. But if he had low earnings, perhaps his rationale makes sense. But if you're making more than 70 grand a year, but less than 138, remember, any dollars going into Social Security after 70, yeah, they're increasing your benefit, but it's minuscule compared to what the first 70 increased your Social Security. And I think getting the $500 employer match into your HSA makes more sense, but I'm not 100% certain because we didn't crunch the numbers.
Yeah, it's my rough calculation. If you're putting $6,000 a year into your HSA, you're going to reduce...
Well, he didn't say how much he's putting in.
Yeah, I know. I'm just throwing some rough numbers out there that the...
If he's single
Social
at
Security
26,
benefit,
he can't put $6,000
true,
in.
True, but I mean...
Okay.
Just pull it out just because I was using this as an example. That would reduce your Social Security benefit. If you were in that 70 to 140 range in earnings, it would reduce your Social Security benefit about $37 a month. So
forever?
Yeah. Or no, so $37 a year.
Okay, I was going to say 37 a month. So, don't listen to me. Put that money in the...
$500 a year for every year moving forward to get back
plus the growth?
$37 a year.
It's a tough call.
No, it isn't.
I don't think he should.
From 67, he'd be 87 years old and only get back 1 year's getting back about $700. He could get $500 a year from his employer.
Well, that's what I mean. I think he'd be better off doing the HSA through the employer and getting
$500. That's what I'm saying. There's my rough numbers. I don't think it's even a contest. I think the $500 is worth way more.
Because that $500 can... What's $500 compounded?
That's not even taken into consideration, the compounding.
That's what I'm saying. If even if he invested at your age, you should be investing in this thing called technology, in case you never heard of it. And again,
maybe depends on his.
Well, I want to say, because compliance listens to this. Yeah. I don't know you, listener. I don't know if you can handle a technology style investment. But at 26, you should be invested aggressively, whether that means an all technology holding or an all equity holding or of a more diversified nature. That's up to you. But if you invested aggressively $500 a year, I don't have my calculator, so I can't do this, but you did it till you retired at 65. So you did it for another 40 years. Let's say you worked to 66 to keep my math round. $500 a year for 40 years, growing at, say, 7%, that's going to be worth some serious bank. 100% tax-free. It just might be worth it. Chris is a little more adamant than me, but...
I did this. I was winging it here, so...
I admire his train of thought. The guy's got definitely a good financial planning mind. But do recognize every dollar into Social Security isn't treated equally. And I think that's where the weakness in your calculation is. You're treating it equally. And it's really only up to the first 70,000 that you get the most bang for your buck. And anything beyond that, between 70 and 140, and over 140, you don't get any bang for your buck. But between 70 and 140, that's a $70,000 window. You get less bang for your buck. Now, if you have low earnings, I like your strategy, perhaps, and max out your Social Security. But if you're above 70, you really need to do some more number crunching. Yeah. All right. Anyways, that's all I wanted to get to on that. I thought it was a great question, even though he threw you under the bus. And he loves cake. And I think... he loves chocolate cake with white frosting.
No, I'm sure
we should take a poll of our listeners because they're very brilliant. What do you prefer, chocolate cake with white frosting or yellow cake with chocolate frosting?
Well, let me clarify. If that's assuming the quality of the cake
is equal.
Is the same.
Yeah, equal.
Because I would take a high-quality chocolate with white over a low-quality yellow with chocolate.
All things being equal, do you want chocolate cake with white frosting or yellow cake...
With
chocolate frosting. Who eats yellow cake? Who eats yellow? You eat yellow snow?
No, I don't
eat
white snow
either.
Exactly,
so why would you eat yellow cake?
I don't eat snow.
Watch out where the Huskies go. Don't you eat that yellow cake. I'm just saying.
Where'd you pull that out?
That's that guy, Zappa. His original song was Watch Out Where the Huskies Go, Don't You Eat That Yellow Cake. But he changed it to Yellow Snow because it rhymed a little better. He hated yellow cake just like I did. You never heard that song? Watch Out Where the Huskies Go, Don't You Eat That Yellow Snow.
Frank Zappa sang that?
I'm pretty sure that was Zappa. That is a song.
I don't remember that one at all.
Really?
Yeah. And I've listened to some Zappa. I mean, it's been a while. But
damn.
Okay. I'll look that one up. Thanks.
Watch Out Where the Huskies Go.
I still like yellow cake, so.
No.
Okay. Are we done?
I think we got to be done.
Yep. Yeah. So, again, if you're a certified financial planner, want to help us get back on track so we can live broadcast the podcast on time, let us know, jim@jimhelps.com.
And one thing I will say, that the person will be working closely with Chris, not with me, but I will add that it is a planning position. We are not looking, we don't need a quote-unquote producer. As our listeners know, our actual non-advisor listeners know, we have put a moratorium, a temporary pause, if you will, on accepting new clients, and we did it solely to take care of our existing clients. Chris and I, it is very hard having a planning firm. It is not scalable, like it would be if we were AUM, assets under management people, where we charge you 1.5% of your assets, throw you in some sort of model, pretend to you that it's not a model, and have software do all the trading, which is what it's done nowadays. I know because that's how we do it with models and software. We can definitely scale that. Doesn't matter if we're managing or rebalancing 10 portfolios or 100 portfolios. Software does it. Now, the proofing takes a little bit longer with 100 portfolios than 10, but for the most part, it is extremely scalable. Mm-hmm. When you are a financial planning practice like Chris and I are, where we don't force our clients to have us manage their money, where we actually provide sound and thorough and in-depth planning and tax projections and aging assistance and all the things we put into our analysis, it is not scalable. The more people we take on, the less we get done.
The more work there is.
The more work there is. So we're not a huge firm. We don't pretend to be a huge firm. And we had, in our opinion, a large amount of people hire us the last quarter of 2019 and the first month of 2020. Now, we've said repeatedly to some other bigger firms, they would might laugh at the amount of clients we took on. But to Chris and I, it was meaningful. And we decided we're going to put a pause. We need to take care of the people who are waiting. We need to take care of our existing clients, and we need to hire some more staff. So we have hired more admin staff, mostly because Laura, our wonderful, wonderful admin, is going to be leaving us. She's having a baby, and she's going to raise her baby, and we have no problem with that. So we've hired new admin staff to help Laura, but Chris and I thought at the same time we should hire some more planners. Mm-hmm. If we had more planners and we could train them well, we may be able to take on more clients, and we won't have to pause in the future if people want to hire us. And that's all fine and dandy, but we need to now find the right person. So the right person should have their CFP, Certified Financial Planner designation, but it's not steadfast. If you have another quality designation, perhaps a CPA or an enrolled agent who always had an interest in planning with a tax focus, or a PFS, which is a CPA with a personal financial specialist designation, or even one of the two new income ones, what is it, RICAP and RICEPIP or something, I don't know, Retirement Income Certified Professional is one, I forget what the other one is. That at least shows us you take retirement planning seriously. We are a planning-centric firm, and we want planners who want to plan. We don't need you selling. I don't need you running out and trying to sell some god-awful brokered product or some commissioned thing. That's not what we do here. We do planning. So that's what we're looking for. We think an ideal candidate would be someone with a few years' experience that we could train. If you have multiple years of experience, you may not be trainable. You can't teach an old dog new tricks.
They might be far enough down their career that they don't want to make a change. So,
and our salary probably doesn't pay what they would want, having 10, 15, 20 years experience for our starting salary. So it's not to discourage someone with a lot of experience. Now, if you are someone with a lot of experience and you're looking to retire and enter a slower stage, we would be very receptive to a pot timer working for us.
Yeah.
So anyways, we are looking. We know that a lot of advisors listen to us trying to learn. For instance, what's the better cake, chocolate cake with white frosting or yellow cake with chocolate frosting? I mean, these are the deep probing things we discuss on this podcast. But if you are a planner, please feel free to reach out to us. Doesn't matter where in the country you live. You will have to come out to Colorado and train with Chris. For a while, we'll put you up. But once your training is done, then you can go back to wherever you came from and work for us remotely.
Yeah.
Anything else you want to add? Because the person's really to work with you.
No, that's about it. I'd say ideally if they're the CFP route, they have their CFP. But if you've got everything except for maybe the tail end of the experience requirement, so maybe you're, you know, you've got work, you've passed the test, you have the education piece down, and you're just waiting for those 6,000 hours to accumulate, and you know, have got 4,000 of them or something, certainly that would, I think, be in the pool of consideration.
Absolutely. So, we have no problem with that. We just want to hire someone, male or female, doesn't matter, who takes the position seriously. And there's no better way to prove in a field that requires absolutely no college education at all to become a financial planner. In a field with such low barriers to entry as my industry is, we feel we should hire at least someone who has done something to set themselves apart and learn. Chris and I know a lot. We don't know everything, but we never stop learning. He doesn't, and I don't. So do not reach out to me if you're interested in this job if you don't want to keep learning, because we constantly learn and challenge ourselves all the time. Okay.
So with that, thanks everybody for listening, and we'll be back with you next week with a brand new show.
You have listened to Jim on the radio, read his quotes in the media, and enjoyed his banter on iTunes. But even now, you may wonder what sets Jim Saulnier and Associates apart from other financial planning companies. The answer is quite simple. Jim's diverse team of professionals specializes in retirement planning. They form a lifelong relationship with you and measure their success not through product sales, but through the security and prosperity you may achieve in your retirement. Jim's entire team shares his unwavering commitment to placing their clients' best interests first while offering their services at fair prices with full disclosures. The professionals at Jim Saulnier & Associates are available to assist you with your retirement planning needs. Visit jimhelps.com to schedule your complimentary coffee and a second opinion meeting. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. Or call 970-530-0556.
Investors should consider the investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses of investment company products carefully before investing. The prospectus contains this and other information about the investment company. Prospectuses may be obtained from your advisor and should be read in full. All guarantees are backed by the claims-paying ability of the issuing insurer. Withdrawals and death benefits are subject to income tax. If withdrawals and other distributions are received prior to age 59 and a half, a 10% penalty may apply. Shares, when redeemed, may be worth more or less than the original cost.
The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Securities offered through Cambridge Investment Research Incorporated, a broker-dealer, member FINRA, SIPC. Advisory services offered through Cambridge Investment Research Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Saulnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor. Jim Saulnier & Associates, LLC, and Cambridge are not affiliated.